Welcome and good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for attending our virtual briefing on nutrigenomics. Now, as I'm sure we're all aware, nutrigenomics is a field of study which looks at how food and food constituents affect our genes. It aims to develop ways for all of us to improve our health by matching our diets to our genetic makeup. With the fourth Asia Pacific Nutrigenomics Conference happening here at the moment, we've been able to put together a panel of both local and international experts to tell everyone a little bit more about the subject. First, and to introduce the subject as a whole, we have Dr. Jim Caput. He is the director of the Division of Personalized Nutrition. Of Personalized Nutrition and Medicine at the United States Food and Drug Administration, or what we think of as the FDA. Next up, we'll be hearing from Dr. Michael Fennick of CSIRO in Australia, who's been looking at how a wide range of simple treatments can affect the health of our DNA. We'll finish up with Professor Lynette Ferguson, who's at the University of Auckland, and she will be telling us a little bit more about the work being done in New Zealand on nutrigenomics, particularly by Nutrigenomics NZ. I'd also like to remind everyone that the audio will be put up on our website following the briefing, and the speaker slides will be available to registered journalists in our resource library. And now I'll hand over to Jim. Jim?
Yeah, thank you very much. So the study of nutrigenomics has actually been around for many, many years. Hippocrates, 2,500 years ago, said, "Let food be your medicine and medicine be your food." So we've known the connections for many, many years, but what we can now do using modern technology is to actually study those interactions at the genetic and molecular level. So this first slide that I show you actually was stolen from Dr. Ferguson about 6 years ago and changed just a little bit. So the idea is that if you're a nutritionist, then you only look at how diet affects the biomarkers. Now, biomarkers are things like your HDL level, the amount of glucose in your blood, et cetera. And a nutritionist would typically look only at those, what you eat and how they affect your biomarkers. A geneticist is going to take a completely different tack. They actually don't look at the diet at all or lifestyle. They look at which genes your mom and dad gave you, and those genes go through a variety of molecular mechanisms to make RNA and proteins, and those proteins affect your metabolites. And they only look at the metabolites in relation to the genes you have. So what nutrigenomics knows and what it tries to study in detail is those dietary chemicals, and a lot of chemicals in the diet are very good for us, interact with various pathways from your genes to your metabolites, and they affect how you your health based on how the genes are expressed or how the proteins are controlled and how the nutrients are metabolized. And that's what those arrows, typically this is animated, and it goes from genes to gene expression and then to proteins and to biomarkers. And the blue arrows show that different dietary chemicals interact or regulate various parts of those pathways. Now, there's many, many books on this already and many articles, and it's too detailed to talk here, but we're very sure that this is true. So the little book on the side, Biochemical Individuality, was published in 1956, which indicates that even though we know the general fact that nutrients affect gene expression and an individual, all of us are slightly different. And that's what we're trying to study. Why do certain individuals respond one way to foods and another individual eating the same foods will have a different health outcome? So if we go to the next slide, do that. So this is just a general slide to show that individuals differ not only in metabolism of the nutrients, which is that all those pathways that a biochemist would like to look at, but also it could affect immune function. So it's very critical that you have the proper nutrients to ward off infections and diseases. It will affect individuals with susceptibility to, let's say, AIDS or other viruses. It will influence cognitive development. And this is really very crucial. Early nutrition, as well as good nutrition for pregnant women or women of childbearing ages, has a direct impact on child's development of cognitive skills and as well as physical development. And then, of course, it actually does influence drug metabolism. And our colleagues in the drug fields or the genetic fields who study how drugs work often forget that dietary chemicals will alter how the enzymes that are produced that metabolize drugs, how much they're produced or how active they are. So we have to actually underpin all of our biomedical studies with analyzing what people eat, because that will influence all of these different pathways. So in my division, as well as in many other areas of academic research, we're trying to personalize nutrition and medicine so that when you go to the doctor, they can decide what types of nutrients are best for your health and also what medicine. So in order to do that, we have to have these five bullet points happen. One is that everybody is going to be analyzed genetically. Right now, there's, of course, some concerns about genetic privacy. In reality, every one of us has some types of variations which make us less than the perfect human, and that everyone has a slightly different one, and that's why some of us can eat the foods and survive for a long time till 90 or 95, while others might be more susceptible to obesity or diabetes. But everybody essentially has to die sooner or later, and that's all encoded in our genes. So we have to analyze our genetics. We also have to have, for these studies, evidence-based data and mechanisms. Much of what we know about health and disease and how drugs are treated are based on population studies and statistical averages, and I'm going to highlight that in a next slide or two. But what we really need to know is the exact mechanisms by which the nutrients affect our health or the drugs work in each person. And I must say the New Zealand group is doing a wonderful job of developing model systems to do that very basic research that is involved in their case, Crohn's disease. And our team has different interests that overlaps a little bit with what's going on over here in New Zealand. The third thing we need are better, what we call, biomarkers. You may know that cholesterol is a very good biomarker for telling you about your heart health, but it really is imperfect. In fact, over time, we've learned that you have to worry about not just your total cholesterol, but the amount of HDL you have or the bad LDL you have. And actually, now there's even more research on other types of LDL. And as we learn more about this, we get better and better measures of a person's disease status. But our teams are also interested in how do you define a healthy person, and if we can define that health, how do we optimize the diet to maintain health over life? So we need to have better markers that are simple to use, that will be able, that individuals can use it very conveniently, that will allow us to measure how healthy they are during life and try to maintain that health. Obviously, this has huge implications for our healthcare costs. If we can prevent disease, it's much better than treating disease. As part of that, we need to have better nutrient and activity assessments. So this is one of the discussions we've been having this week at the conference. Right now, you can download about 100 applications on your iPhone that can monitor, or you can use it to monitor your food intake or your physical activity, but we don't have a lot of these automated for our research community, and we need more of them. However, even though we're focused right now on developing better research, we believe that these tools will be able to be used in clinical settings so that, let's say, you go to the doctor's office and the first part of your visit will be to sit down and then tell a computer program about what you're eating or how much physical activity you have, or perhaps uploading some of your diet information from food stores or your activity from a pedometer, so that we can start linking your physical lifestyle with your health outcomes. And then finally, what we're very interested in as we do this research is trying to develop a cost benefit for implementation. Our societies are very well suited to know how much it costs to develop a drug and what it will mean for our economy, but we have very little information about why prevention research or the the results of prevention research, what that will do positively for our economy. We, of course, know that they reduce disease, and we can say it's going to reduce diabetes costs or obesity. But we also believe that these new ideas that we're promoting and developing are going to generate, let's say, business for a nutritionist to be in a doctor's office to help the physician give dietary advice, or the pedometers, or the heart rate monitors, or physical activity at gyms, et cetera. So all of these are going to be a positive investment in our economies, and we think that's important to track. Now, it's actually quite difficult to do these studies, and that's what's shown on the next slide if it's just a general overview. The problems are that our foods are very, very complex. We recognize that, but we believe we have ways to start studying what those complexities are. Part of that is that when you grow foods in different parts of the world, their composition, their chemical composition varies. Each of our cultures grow, prepares foods differently. We have different ways of types of eating, like times and different holidays and different lifestyles day to day. And, of course, food processing in manufacturing also varies our food composition. However, with the technologies we have, we think we can address that and analyze those technologies, those differences. And then, of course, health and disease vary greatly depending on who you are and what your physiological conditions are, whether you exercise, whether you eat well. All of that will influence the physiology, and that variation is difficult to measure. But we, again, have tools now that can do that. And then we also know now more than ever that each individual human is slightly different. While there are groups of individuals, individuals within the group are slightly different. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but the little picture that you see at the bottom that's color-coded red, yellow, and green are Hispanic individuals in either Puerto Rico or San Francisco. And each line, either red or yellow or the mix, are their genetic makeup. So a person who's considered a Latino can have all of their chromosomes from Native Americans, which is in red. They could have them all from Europeans, which is in yellow. Or they could have various mixes of European chromosomes and African chromosomes and Native Americans. And yet we lump them all together for both nutritional studies and genetic studies and say they're Latino. And obviously, individuals of different genetic makeups are going to respond differently. So we know that people are all alike because we're all human, but we also know that they're different. And now we have the tools to start separating that out in our studies. So the way that we do these studies, and unfortunately this is not animated, but what I show here is that if you label individuals first, let's say obese and not obese, or let's say someone who has a disease versus not a disease, and then you put them into these little bins, and then you measure the average response of the individual, you're actually generating what we call a population attributable risk. That PAR is actually a group average. So all of the information right now that we have for what you should eat or what medicines are good for you are based on group averages. But I'm not in that picture, and my genotype isn't represented, and my lifestyle isn't represented. So we have to ask the question, is the result good for me? It may or may not be. Now, when we talk to media, we want to highlight that we don't want to throw out all of the advice that biomedical research has generated. This is the best available information we have. However, if we're going to go to personalization, we have to think about how to do the experiment slightly differently. So that is shown on the next slide graphically, in that we have a distribution of health in the population. That's the blue curve. We have a distribution of disease, and you can see they overlap, the red line and the blue line overlap, and we have the statisticians calculate this attributable risk or the risk factor. And then we say, well, if you eat blueberries, it's going to be healthy for you, but that's on average. That doesn't mean I should eat a lot of blueberries. Again, it's the best knowledge we have, but we want to do personalization. So we want to know how each individual responds rather than how the group responds. if you go to the next one, the way that we're doing this is instead of separating people into two groups, cases and controls, what we're saying is that with all these fancy techniques we have, we can first characterize everybody, both genetically and how much they eat or what types of food they eat, their physiology, all of that. And after we characterize them, then we can put them into groups. And we do have information that metabolic groups exist so that certain individuals may be best suited, let's say, for a certain level of vitamins or a certain type of fat or a certain amount of carbohydrates. It's still pretty early, but we have very good evidence that this is going to work. The way that we're trying to do this is we're trying to do this in real life. Well, now, a lot of times, as you guys who are covering science know, we do these studies in the laboratory or we take the samples from individuals and we go do our analysis, we publish our paper, and we never see the individuals that we're working with again. There's a new emphasis on what's called translational research, where you monitor an individual over time and you see how a drug works in that individual. What we're doing is using that technique in a variety of different settings to say, how does an individual respond to changes in diet or food intake or physical activity? And we're trying to link that back to their genetic makeup. So that's called translational research. And it involves the types of things we normally do in the laboratory, the basic technologies, omics and model research. It requires a lot of informatics because we got to capture a lot of data. But it's mainly a subject and a patient-centered research program where the patient or the subject of the work is the center of the activities and you monitor them over time. And so we do a whole set of assessments, which is in the blue wording next to the circles there. We measure clinical assessments at, let's say, fasting blood levels like we always do. We intervene either medically or with a different diet, and we say, how do you change? We do genomic analysis. But the key is we don't just say, go out and eat better. We say, go out and eat better, and can we ask you to come in and let us assess whether you are eating better and whether that food is helping you by changing your biomarkers. So this is a slightly different and more detailed approach that we're using in our research to try and do basic research, but at the same time have it applied and help each individual that we look at in our study. Now, this work is really very cool. We're at the early stages of it. We have huge international groups that are forming to work together. But really what we know best about health is shown on my last slide, which is we have to move more, we have to eat less, and we have to choose our ancestors wisely. And I think that's the message that we have to give to the general public now through the media, which is that we are generating the information to know the types of foods. There's no magic bullet, especially right now. So you can't just say, I got to eat a quart of blueberries a day and I'm going to be healthy because I have a lot of antioxidants. We have to have people just move a little bit more. And I don't even use the word exercise anymore. I think if we just have the positive message of being more active and eat a little bit less, not necessarily go on these really high restricted diets, but just start having smaller portions and more fresh fruits and vegetables. And then, of course, if you're lucky, you have parents and grandparents that live a long time, you're going to live a long time, too. So ultimately, we want to put real science behind these little words. But right now, this is the best thing we can tell people. So thank you.
Wonderful, Jim. That was great. Thank you. I'll pass on to Michael.
Okay. I thought we were going to ask questions after each.
We'll do questions at the end is probably best.
So, okay, you could put the slide up.
Yes.
Oh, you must. All right. Do I move them as well?
Yes.
Okay, so I shall be speaking about the impact of nutrition on DNA damage, okay? So we've known for a while that inappropriate nutrition can cause damage to DNA, and that this damage in DNA is increasing the risk of infertility, pregnancy complications, developmental defects, and degenerative diseases of old age, such as cancer, as well as accelerating the aging process. So. Now, in interacting and translating this knowledge into practice to the public, we use the term genome health. So rather than talk about damage, we adopt a positive terminology, and hence this terminology is being used in this translation process, which is why the title of my presentation here is Genome Health Clinics for Personalized DNA Damage Prevention. Now, this concept has already been published. On this first slide, you can see two publications, and a movie was done on this on Australian science program, the Catalyst, the DNA Doctor story, which you might have had time to see. Page down, next slide. All right, so we know that there are many factors that can impact the genome adversely. So what we're talking about here is damage to the DNA in such a way that the chromosomes are broken, or you might end up, which means that you might end up with some DNA absent from the daughter cells, or excess DNA, which we know affects the phenotype of the cells adversely. And malnutrition is one of those key factors that affects DNA damage in people, and as well as lifestyle genotoxins, such as smoking and alcohol, and there are other factors such as psychological stress. So we're focusing on the nutritional aspect. And we know that the susceptibility to these adverse events can either be genetic, in other words, inherited defects in DNA repair, for example, or acquired because of changes in gene expression with age. And the impact of DNA damage is particularly higher in the early stages of life, but it's still relevant even later on in life. Now, there are many ways that DNA damage can be measured in cells. Our laboratory has developed a method to measure DNA damage in people very easily using a blood a small sample of blood, in which the lymphocytes, the white vessels, are cultured for a brief period. And when the cells divide, they express this damage as small nuclei within the cells. So the binucleated cells, so with two nuclei you see on the right-hand side of the slide, is actually a human lymphocyte from a person, and the small nuclei within that cell, the micronuclei, are actually DNA damage events, chromosomal DNA damage events. And we use this biomarker, which is now being used worldwide and standardized. It's also an OECD accepted test for in vitro genetic toxicology tests. We use this test to determine DNA damage in people and to study how micronutrient deficiency or excess affects DNA damage.